From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The year 2018 marks the 200th birthday of Karl Marx, a Western philosopher who changed global perspectives on the economy and the value of labor and goods. Sensing an increasing attraction to the ideas of Marxism and socialism among the American public, Donald Trump's Council of Economic Advisors recently released a bizarre document entitled The Opportunity Costs of Socialism. The report attempted to make an empirical case for why socialism does not work. In doing so, the authors inadvertently made the case for a single-payer system that conservatives have derided as socialist. Vox's Sarah Cliff pointed out that a chart intended to show longer wait times for seniors seeking health care in various countries includes the U.S. having the shortest wait times. But of course, seniors in the U.S. enjoy the benefits of Medicare, a single-payer system just for those over the age of 65. Many have pointed out that the report is intended to counteract the growing popularity of a Medicare-for-all system among the public and politicians, especially Democrats, as well as the popularity of socialism as an economic system. To analyze the report, we turn today to one of the nation's preeminent Marxist economists, Richard Wolff. He's a visiting professor at the New School University in New York, a professor of economics emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He's written many books, including Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism, Occupy the Economy, Challenging Capitalism, Imagine Living in a Socialist USA, and Capitalism's Crisis Deepens, Essays on the Global Economic Meltdown. Welcome back to the show, Richard.
Thank you, Sonali. I'm glad to be here.
So I feel that the sheer publication of this report is in some ways a success for socialism's popularity. They're recognizing that it's something that is tempting people into considering it as a system, and they're attempting desperately to counteract it, right?
Absolutely. I think that everyone in America, and it's a fast-growing number of people that, if not themselves, socialists certainly think that a debate between capitalism and socialism that honestly confronts the strengths and weaknesses of both of them is long overdue after the kind of Cold War taboo on such honest discussions is breaking up. And it's clear that this report issued earlier this week by the Trump administration is a lame, and I'll explain that in a couple of minutes, a very lame effort to try to block or thwart or stem the growing interest in socialism. And it is, as you say, a kind of indirect admission that they know they've got a problem on their hands.
One of the things that the report attempts to do is to have a very interesting and unstated assumption that undergirds the entire report. And that assumption seems to be drawn directly from the work of Ayn Rand, this idea that we have to measure the success of an economy by the purchasing power of ordinary people, by the ability of ordinary people to just have extra money to spend. Is that something that struck you?
Yes, it struck me that they would use that particular metric. It's one of many that economists use. It's not the preeminent one, but okay, I don't have any objection if they want to make an argument based on that question. But what is incredible when you read through this report is the shoddy, incompetent way that they have gone about it. I can assure you, having taught at Yale University and the University of Massachusetts and quite a few other places, if ever any of my colleagues, right-winger, left-winger, or a man or woman in the middle, if they had taught a course in comparative systems, capitalism and socialism, which we often did, if a student had written something like this government report, that student would have been called into the office to try to account for the kind of lopsided argumentation that was offered. It's really poor. Let me illustrate. If you're going to use the argument that you measure the success of a system by the amount and often the pace of rising standards of living, then over the last 25 years, for example, there is no question in anyone's mind in which country on this planet the standards of living of hundreds of millions of people rose faster than it has ever risen in any country in the history of the world. And the country I'm referring to is the People's Republic of China. It is absolutely stunning that in this report, they neglected to inform the reader that if you want to measure a success story, then the socialism, which is what the Chinese call their economy, and I'm not going to address here whether that's reasonable or not, that's a separate matter, but they call it a socialist economy. Much of the world calls it a socialist economy. And by the standard of rising standards of living, they win. They went much further, much faster than any other country. Over the last 30 years, China went from a poor, underdeveloped country to the second most important economic power in the world, moving 300 to 400 million people out of agriculture into a much higher standard of living in the cities of China. The ability to write a report as if none of that happened is either intellectually dishonest or a slight variation on that, counting on a public that isn't educated enough to see through the really shoddy work that's done here.
The report addresses Cuba's agricultural production before and after the nationalization of farms. I'm not sure if they take into account the embargo on Cuba when they measure what took place there.
No, it's this kind of, you know, ideological Cold War kind of argumentation. Reading it reminded me of the kind of stuff that passed for analysis back in the 1960s or 70s. It's really crazy. Yes, Cuba has had a lot of problems. Carefully avoided is the fact that the United States, its major trading partner, had number one, invaded the country, tried to overthrow it. Number two, enacted an embargo against trade with it. Number three, muscled most of the rest of Latin America to join in this kind of relationship. I mean, to not mention any of that, as if when you're looking at what happened in Cuba, all that you're looking at is the question of a socialist versus a capitalist system and none of the other influences on what happened there. Again, this is when you call a student in, you don't even give them a bad grade because it's worse than that. They're not showing the basic ability to go in and look at all of this. This is pure shoddy propaganda, and it's kind of a shame. It's an embarrassment, and I think people will look back on that report as a kind of low point in a regime that was already contesting with other low points.
Now, one of the favorite examples that U.S. politicians like to give as a demonstration of socialism's failures is Venezuela. And there's a chart, there's a graph showing total petroleum production comparing Canada and Venezuela, showing the fall off of Venezuela's oil production. I'm not sure if that's something that you have a critique of, but to me, it also seems as though it shouldn't be our measure of the success of an economy shouldn't be linked to fossil fuel production, should it?
No, fossil fuel is its own history, its own story. It's an economy, Venezuela, that's overwhelmingly dependent on one particular product. We call that monoculture, namely oil, and therefore it rises and falls with the oil industry and the money that that makes available to a country. Look, to measure socialism by what happened over recent years in one country would be about as meaningful as to measure how capitalism is doing by picking a poor country in Latin America or an even poorer one in Africa or another poor one in some other part of the world. This is childish. If you're going to evaluate a system, you're going to have to look at the parts of it that are not doing well, by all means, the parts of it that are doing well, and you have to do the same for the system you're comparing in order to make anything that passes a minimum muster as honest evaluation. The Council of Economic Advisers was set up by a law passed in 1946. That council is supposed to exist to advise the president on what's happening to the American economy so that the president can make appropriate suggestions to Congress on what to do to avoid the next capitalist downturn. Mm-hmm. Writing reports on subjects of capitalism versus socialism is something they were never set up to do and which they have almost never done in their history that I'm aware of. So this is a departure. Nicely released a couple of weeks before an election in the hopes of pandering to the same political base they're trying to get out to vote. It was done slapdash by incompetent people in a shoddy, crude way. It's a shame and an embarrassment for a country to produce this kind of junk. It does take you back to the worst times of the Cold War, and it's beneath contempt in terms of anything proposing to be an argument with evidence. And I won't even go into the other things. There's a vast literature on comparing economic systems. It's a course in the university at both undergraduate and graduate levels. Anyone who does that, as I've done it, can give the government a reading list with many of the books and articles that are mostly used, none of which appear in the bibliography of this report, leading one to believe, since it's easy just to list them, that they weren't even able to come up with a plausible list of books and articles to justify what looks like a couple of folks on too much coffee banged out over a weekend. It really is a shoddy piece of work.
Well, Richard, I think you really hit the nail on the head about the issue of this pandering to the Republican base, because a big part of the critique of this report has honed in, I think rightly so, on one particular graph, figure 6 in the report, the weekly cost of owning and operating a pickup truck by country, showing somehow that the U.S. is superior to Denmark, Norway, Sweden, and Finland, because it's so much easier to own a pickup truck in the U.S. I thought this was my most favorite laughable part of the report.
Yes, it just shows you, since there are literally 50 metrics that exist in the literature to compare economic systems that they could have used, they found a metric I've never seen used before. That's because they had to search long and hard to find a table that makes the United States look in some way better than other countries, because that's so hard to do. And let me underscore this by talking about one more aspect of the report. It's top heavy and overloaded with references to medicine and medical insurance and health insurance. And it's clear, as many have pointed out, that part of this document is to try to undercut the interest of large numbers of Americans in healthcare and their disappointment in the Trump GOP government's attitude towards it. They want you to believe that having a single payer health system, a kind of governmental health insurance, will cost you more money. I find this again mind-bogglingly dishonest. Here is the basic fact they never face up to and are afraid to deal with. If you compare the United States, not only with other rich industrialized countries, but with virtually most countries in the world, here are the two facts you need to know. One, the overwhelming majority of them have a national insurance guarantee, single payer, mixed private, public, there's a variety. But they all do more than we do in the United States in the way of providing public, universal, subsidized health care. And the second fact is that the amount of money per person spent on health care in the United States is much higher than it is in every one of those other countries. In other words, our private capitalist healthcare system makes it more costly for us than the other healthcare systems make for their people. And when you add to that, that the outcomes, the health outcomes in other countries are better. For example, many of these countries that have a nationalized health system live longer than we do. They're in the hospital less days per year than Americans
are. We didn't see any of those charts comparing.
None of those charts. And instead, this crazy number that somebody pulled out of their hat, that if we had a single payer system, it would cost every American $7,000. This isn't just an argument. This is so close to political propaganda that it really doesn't deserve the paper it's printed on. This is BS of the worst political hack variety.
Now, Richard, Bernie Sanders and other proponents of Medicare for All were very happy that this report inadvertently made a case for Medicare for All when it singled out the wait times for seniors seeking health care, compared to the U.S. wait times to wait times for seniors in other nations, and showed how the wait times for seniors in the U.S. was so much lower than, say, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, France, etc., where there are socialized healthcare systems. And of course, seniors here in the U.S. have Medicare, which is a socialist program, essentially, but restricted to people over the age of 65. So that was, I don't know, was that an oversight, you think, or they were just hoping people wouldn't notice?
No, I think I'll go back to my metaphor from before. This looks like something cooked up by tired people who had drunk too much coffee and had stayed up too late over the last weekend when they had to hand this thing in to whoever their superiors were. And so they couldn't take the time or the care to avoid neither the shoddy, incompetent argumentation nor the choice of examples that end up making a better case against them than they made a case for what they were trying to say. Here's the impression I think it would leave. People who know anything about socialism will laugh at this report. People who don't know anything and are against it may feel somewhat encouraged that the government is validating their point of view. But any honest human being, and I assume most Americans are, that takes a look at this will walk away and shake their head, not so much at the substance of this report, because there ain't much substance in it, but at the shoddy, incompetent, lopsided work that is evidenced here. Makes you frightened if that's the kind of research that goes into their foreign trade war or their withdrawal from the nuclear treaties. If this is the kind of reasoning that John Bolton and people like that are using, then this country is in even worse shape than most of us already find it to be in.
Richard, the op-ed that Trump supposedly wrote in USA Today a few weeks ago about socialism and the dangers that it poses is part of, it sounds like, this sort of fear-mongering on Medicare for All. I'm seeing a lot of articles, you know, written by people like Stephen Moore with the Heritage Foundation and others publishing news articles now pointing out the radical nature of the Medicare for All system, also sort of suggesting that those who are proponents of Medicare for All don't know the end game, don't know the details, leading Americans down a path to this unknown vague place. So we're seeing a lot of fear mongering in the media because this talking point is so popular. Do you worry that some people will sort of succumb and fall for this fear mongering?
Yes, I think that they will. I mean, look, fear-mongering is the stock in trade of the Trump administration. I watched the other day the president, you know, pulling out of his hat, as he likes to do. He was telling me and the American people that there were ISIS terrorists mingled in to the Honduran refugees working their way to the American border. That's just simple fear-mongering. Mr. Bolton went to Russia to give a press conference saying the Russians are cheating on missile arrangements. That's to scare people that way. Wherever we go, we're being scared. We're being told we have to fight wars in other countries, otherwise they will come and fight the wars here. It's an endless program, and so we shouldn't be surprised that the old, tired, dead horse that providing a nationalized, subsidized healthcare insurance for all Americans, which the overwhelming majority of the people have always supported, that is somehow going to cost you a fortune of money or going to have you dictated to by a death panel deciding whether you live or not. These are the desperate efforts of fear-mongering when any political argument is obviously going to fail. That you don't resort to this sort of stuff because it is so obvious, unless you really have nothing better to offer. That's why the shoddy pamphlet about socialism, you don't have an argument against socialism. More and more socialists are running for office. More and more socialists are winning office. More and more socialism is in the air. And this government can't do better than more fear-mongering. Oh, goodness, if we have national health, it'll cost you money. Carefully avoiding dealing with the reality that Americans already pay more for health care than any other country on the face of this earth, which should long ago have been more than enough critique that a private capitalist health care system is not an efficient mechanism for delivering quality health care. Every other country in the world has figured that out. We haven't, not because we're not smart, but because we have a vested interest, a medical industrial complex that spends the money to fund the Republicans and the Trump-type people to keep scaring enough Americans to slow at least the process, even though in the end they will not succeed in preventing it.
And incidentally, Richard, just to get back on this issue of fear-mongering and out-and-out lies, on Wednesday, President Trump tweeted just such a bald-faced lie, which of course shouldn't surprise us, but he tweeted, "Republicans will totally protect people with pre-existing conditions. Democrats will not. Vote Republican." He tweeted this just a few days after his Department of Health and Human Services released new rules weakening protections of the Affordable Care Act and making it easier for the insurance companies to sell plans discriminating on the basis of pre-existing conditions. And of course, it was the ACA, which Republicans have tried to dismantle, that first banned discrimination against people with pre-existing conditions. Just amazing how you see this complete turnaround, just complete opposites of the real of reality being put out as a fear-mongering tactic. Are you heartened by how Democrats have come around on the issue of Medicare for All? We now have a Medicare for All caucus led by, you know, people like Pramila Jayapal and others, progressive House members. More and more Democrats seeking re-election are running on a platform of explicitly saying Medicare for All. And the Democratic Party as a whole seems to have finally sort of given in, been dragged down the path by grassroots pressure to support Medicare for All.
Yes, I think it's, to be real honest and to boast a little bit, it's not just grassroots pressure. It's the pressure of the progressive part of those grassroots. It's the pressure that was begun by the Occupy Wall Street movement that was picked up and developed in dramatic ways by the Bernie campaign, picked up again by Black Lives Matter, picked up again by at least the progressive wing of the hashtag MeToo movement, and so on. Things are shifting in the United States. The government and big business and the Republicans may be pulling the country to the right, no question. But the reality of a system that isn't working for the majority of people, that pulls an awful lot of people the other way. And the Democratic Party is being, as you rightly put it, dragged, kicking and screaming, at least the center that runs it and owns it, being pulled and pushed because they're learning slowly and painfully that the Democrats have to stand for something. They can't just be the not Trump. That's a very dangerous campaign. It's still mostly what they've done. and the little bit of positivity of something they can actually be for that people might have as a reason to bother to go vote for them. It's a late coming, and I don't know whether it'll be successful, but it is a sign that the future of any kind of successful Democratic Party doesn't lie with the old establishment that has to be dragged kicking and screaming into being for something that might make people feel the energy of making social change.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Richard, for joining us. You, of course, have also been instrumental in pushing out clear-eyed analyses of socialism. Where can people watch the program that you put together, Economic Update, and also find out about your work?
Well, like you, Economic Update is a weekly program. It's carried on all the 5 major Pacifica stations and about 100 others across the country. And it also comes out as a television show through the Free Speech Network and several other networks around the country. And I would urge those of you that are interested, look us up on YouTube or on Patreon.com. Just look for the name Economic Update. And through that program every week, you can get introduced to all the different things we do.
Thank you so much, as always, Richard, for joining us.
Thank you, Sonali, and I look forward to our next chance to talk.
Likewise. My guest has been Richard Wolff, visiting professor at the New School University in New York, professor of economics emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, author of a number of books critiquing capitalism, including Occupy the Economy, Challenging Capitalism, Imagine Living in a Socialist USA, and Capitalism's Crisis Deepens. We've been discussing the new White House report attempting to critique socialism. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and now on Instagram at RU with Sonali.